It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Gina's got the week off. Mike Elgin joins Jeff Jarvis and me. We're going to talk about, of course, a big announcement from Amazon, a new streaming platform. Happy Birthday Gmail, the 10th anniversary of everybody's favorite email program. And how many views on Google Plus do you have? We'll measure next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 243, recorded April 2nd, 2014. This Old Fart. This Week in Google is brought to you by 99designs, the world's largest graphic design marketplace. 99designs connects businesses seeking quality, affordable designs with a community of more than 280,000 graphic designers. Visit 99designs.com/twig to receive a free power pack upgrade valued at $99. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, visit personalcapital.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about Google, Facebook, the Googleverse. Gina Trapani has the day off. Mike Elgin is sitting in. Nice to have you, Mike.
Glad to be here. I came all the way from
across
over there.
The hall.
So glad to be here.
Also from his book-lined study. Where did you buy those books by the feet?
They're just props.
Okay.
It's a green screen.
Mr. Jeff Jarvis. Somebody was saying, and I think this is true, that as we get to this digital world, books will become more and more precious. In fact, books will never be as inexpensive as they are today. So buy.
That's right. I'm a big book collector.
I've had
them in storage for a long time. It's really a great time to go to bookstores, buy old books, nice books. Look out for acid-free paper because they'll destroy them.
But you raise the exact point, which is I've got them in storage because it's not convenient to move them around.
No, it is not.
But it is nice.
I went to the Strand bookstore the other day, and I was wondering what their business is like now. What's the used book business like now?
Well, I guess that's the point, is that, in fact, it's going to get very good because...
But there's less...
It's not a mass market anymore.
No.
But as a specialty market, it's going to be quite good. And I think that many people, certainly the three of us, love books, right? So that's not going away.
The reality is that almost everything being produced nowadays will be with us forever. You'll be able to find Gutenberg the Geek in 300 years and just like search for it, download it, and so on. But before everything was being scanned and digitized, those copies are the only copies. And my wife buys these books that are about food production, making wine and stuff at home. And the content in it is amazing. This is lost information.
Yeah.
And there are also a lot of books in lost languages. And the internet is sort of killing off lost languages as well. So it's a great thing to collect, not only from a collector's point of view, but also from a cultural preservation point of view.
But I think that's kind of the point, is that it's not really killing it off. It's just, as a mainstream interest, it is not huge. But, in fact, I think the internet makes it possible for us, those small few who care about these obscure books together, to find them, to buy them. In a way, it facilitates that as much as it's killing it off.
Absolutely. I mean, if in the old days, you had to go from bookstore to bookstore to bookstore asking questions, where do you have this book? Now you can have a running search for, I don't know, Craigslist, eBay, whatever, for a very obscure title. And you can wait for 3 years. I've done this. And then, boom, it pops up and you buy it. It's like, it's a great...
Let's not forget, that's how Amazon started, was not only selling new books, but they quickly went into used books.
Yep.
So speaking of Amazon...
I'm going to go to my closet for 1 second. I'll be right back.
He's going into the closet, folks. This is
He'll
unprecedented.
Come out of the closet.
Into and out of in one show. he's probably going to get a book.
He's going to have a cape when he comes back.
I'm thinking, but let's take a look at Jeff's office. Well, oh, shoot, he's back. I was going to...
He has neither cape nor...
You know, we interviewed on Triangulation on Monday. We interviewed Michio Kaku, and he has the most... It's a typical... What do you expect a physicist's library would be with Professor Stacks? He's at CUNY as well, right, Jeff? Do you know Michio?
No.
He his office was...
The physics guy.
Dr. Kaku, the physics guy, yeah.
Yeah.
His books, like, worse than that. I mean, like, piled everywhere. Your office is a pristine wonderland compared to his. But I could not help. I could not resist looking at the spines, seeing what is he reading. What is he reading? It's fascinating stuff.
Spider-Man comics and stuff.
Mostly, yeah.
This is the stuff that gets me, too. This was, like, drinking game, folks. Drinking game.
Gutenberg.
Printed in 1476.
So Jeff's now holding up. You have a page from Gutenberg Press?
Gutenberg era, 1476, out of Cologne.
Wow, that's so cool.
Somewhere there's
Conrad Vinters.
Somewhere there's a Gutenberg Bible with a page missing.
So what is it, a Bible? What is it?
This is a page from the Mammotracus Super Biblium.
Oh, it's a super book.
Saw the movie.
early commentary based on sacred scriptures, I wanted to have it for that reason. I just wanted to, have something that was this early.
Oh, absolutely.
The printing press will be by the 600th birthday, it'll be a museum piece. Printing press.
Oh yeah. Well, today, this morning at 11, I got to interview the man who made that all possible. Vint Cerf, who was one of the architects of the internet, the guy who with Bob Kahn created TCP/IP. He was at DARPA in the earliest days of the internet. He then worked at MCI, where he created MCI Mail, one of the very early email implementations. We talked a little bit about that. Founded the Internet Society with Bob Kahn, founded ICANN, and was the chair of ICANN for many years, and is currently vice president and internet evangelist at Google. And it was just really great to talk to him. And I had to say at the end, I teared up a little bit, because at the end, it's like, I had to say, I just want to thank you. Because the work you and Bob and others did in those days, not so long ago, 30, 40 years ago, literally changed the world. And sometimes not, maybe books aren't as big as they used to be or whatever, but it really did change the world. He said one of the things that became very apparent to them, I said, in the early days, did you envision what's happened now? He said, the obvious trite answer would be no. But in fact, many of us, as we started to use this thing, realized that It was not about technology or even computers. It was about communication. And that as we started linking up people, the power of what was about to happen was very obvious. I think
that's the key to it, Leo. And we still, in my business, in our business, we still see the internet in media terms as content and as publications and pages and things like that. And that's not what it's about at all. It's a connection machine. That's the essential architecture of the net, and that's what it enables.
That interview will be out on a Twit special, and there's also a
Hangout. It's already up on YouTube.
Yes. Yeah, it'll be instantly on YouTube because it was a YouTube. Google Hangout. We've actually created a Twit Google Hangouts channel. You finally got to me, Jeff.
Let's hang up, Chad. I'll go back to my
I'm surrounded by Google Plus fanatics. That is a great technology, speaking of communication.
It really is.
Yeah.
Especially Hangouts on Air. If you think about what you can do with Hangouts on Air and compare it to 5 years ago, what it would take to do a live global broadcast in real time, capable of having an audience of hundreds of thousands of people. You'd need a truck and a license and a big van with the satellite dish. And I mean, it's astonishing.
Leo, if you started Twit today, what would your technology choices be?
Well, we're pretty much what we do now, because we continually evolve as technology improves. When we just started doing the screensavers on Tech TV in 1998, even then we wanted to have video calls on the show. We actually got 3Com to give us, I think, 10,000 of those little ball cameras.
Yeah.
And we called it the ZDTV, Netcam Network. I said they wanted to call them webcams. I said, it's not the web. You can't call it. It's a Netcam.
You lost that one.
Yeah, I've lost them all. Netcast, Netcam, I can't win. But I think strictly speaking, it isn't a webcam.
Yeah.
Then it was such a primitive technology that we couldn't really get audio and video. So we'd say, do the video and then be on the phone. So all of our callers on the show were on a phone. And then the video was one frame a second. So you didn't lose lip sync because you could barely see their mouth move. But it worked. And then so as that was 16 years ago. As the technology's advanced, we're using Skype now. Are you on Hangouts or are you
on Skype? Yeah. Because I listen to you, boss.
Well, we'd like to get something better. and we're always testing stuff. The engineers are always in the basement. That's what they tell me they're doing.
The biggest limitation with doing Google Plus is that if as a policy is that you know a lot of people that you're going to have on the show, you say, let's do a Hangout. And then they're like, okay, so where is it? The interface discoverability for new users of Hangouts is not great. And Skype is, you know, everybody understands it at this point. So that's
really,
the only
Mike, that's a really, really good point because it's so ingrained and built into Plus and Mail and stuff. But they almost should just make a Hangout thing just for people to get into it and understand it.
The future really is WebRTC. And this is actually related to Hangouts.
Yep.
And I suspect that in a year or two, that's what we'll be using. And the neat thing about WebRTC, which Google has been supporting, I don't know, they didn't create it, it's open, but I think that they've really been the chief proponents of it, is that I could give you a website, URL, and you'd go to it, and the communication, the call would be established.
We did it on the show, right after it was announced. We did it. It was that easy. It was that doable. Somebody wrote us an app for it.
That's the way it should be.
That is a webcam.
Yep.
That's a web net. Yeah, that's a webcast. Actually, it's not really using the web, just the web for the signal.
All right.
But that, I think, is exciting because then any link can be a call.
Right. You can send people the link, and that's done.
And remember, Kevin Marks has been talking a lot on the last couple of episodes about Tontech Select and what he's doing to kind of create this, you know, mobile page that allows you to just press a button and call somebody. It should be easier, you know, and so I think we're getting close to that. But let's talk about.
I was also struck last week when I was late for the show.
Yeah,
and before we got on air,
that was amazing.
I got the call from Chad, and I was in the car, and my phone is you know installed on the dash, and I hit answer, and there I am driving the car, saying I'm hurrying. But it's that easy to be talking to somebody.
Yep. Find that mind-boggling.
It is. It really is.
In 1965, I remember going to the New York World's Fair, and AT&T showed his famous video phone. And the future. Yeah. I remember 2001, the future, we'll all be seeing each other in phone calls. And it didn't happen because everybody said, you know, you don't want to see anybody in a phone call because everybody wants to brush their hair for a phone call. And yet, we see a lot of video calls all of a sudden. Everybody's doing it all the time. We do it all the time.
Yeah,
I think we've made Skype work for us. Yeah. Wouldn't have a network without Skype, but there's going to be something to replace it soon. I hope. Yesterday, 10 years ago, boy, was that a revolution! And Harry McCracken, great job on Time Magazine's Technologizer site. The 10th anniversary of Gmail, and he has the inside story with Paul Buchheit. The architect and others from Google talking about it. It was a near thing.
Yep.
Almost didn't happen. Folks at Google thought, well, we're really a search engine company. I don't know about this email thing. In fact, even when it launched, you remember how hard it was to get an invite? There were people, I think Harry says in his article, he bought an invite on eBay. There's a picture of Paul Buchheit when he was first at Google. He was employee number 23 at Google. Then went off to start FriendFeed. Who can forget? which I loved. With three of the Google Gmail folks went and
you and three other friends.
It was just me and my friends.
That was FriendFeed.
Loved FriendFeed. Facebook bought it.
Yeah.
And then the rest is history.
Swallowed it, digested it.
There was so little support at Google that even when they launched it, it was running on, what did they say, 300 Pentium 2 computers that nobody else at Google wanted.
That's right. That's one of the things you learn when you learn about how Google works. Everybody's jockeying for compute resources, and it's this big who gets what and where they move it around. And Google historically has always made huge use of old and busted and lousy computers. They don't care how broken down and busted the computers are because they're one of their early innovations was to be able to use computers that fail with two-digit percentages.
Right.
I mean, and so that was pretty interesting.
Fail over. Actually, it was Pentium 3 computers. I apologize.
Yeah. But one of the interesting things about this is that, of course, you know, this launched on April Fool's Day. They did it on purpose. This is something I didn't know. Google did this on purpose, and Larry and Sergey actually wanted to launch it on April Fool's because they knew people would think it was a hoax, and they thought, this is like a double April Fool's joke.
Sergey was the most excited about it, said Rakowski. The ultimate April Fool's joke was to launch something kind of crazy on April 1st and have it still exist on April 2nd.
And the craziest thing about it was that it was a gigabyte of storage, which nowadays...
even that wasn't automatic. As Harry points out in his article, that was something like 300 times the amount of space Yahoo Mail offered.
Yeah.
Yahoo Mail existed, Hotmail existed, so it wasn't the first web-based email.
That was one of the points Vint made about MCI Mail, is how as soon as mail became interconnected, charging for mail went out the window.
Yep. Yeah, he's talked about that. I talked about that with him. He was in his old office at MCI, where he had invented MCI Mail. So that was kind of interesting.
I had an MCI Mail account. I remember that. That was pretty cool.
Oh, so did I.
So the other thing that was interesting about this is that everybody, when you tell the story of Gmail, everybody says, oh, this is a 20% time project. And in fact, it wasn't. It was this guy worked on it full time for 3 years by, more or less by himself. He got help here and there, but it was essentially this single guy working on it. And he had this personal, and again, this is a great story by Harry McCracken, who uncovers all this stuff very nicely. But he has this obsession with making sure that whatever he's using is functional. So after one day, he had a functional, essentially a search engine for email.
He said he said from him personally, but I think this is more than just Paul Buchheit. He said, I find I lose interest in a project if I can't use it right away. Yeah. So my first goal is to immediately make something I can use and then iterate on it to make it useful.
We're so used to good search from Google that you have to pause and realize how much bad search is out there. Even today, the
app, just look for something on the App Store on Apple.
Forget about it.
It's impossible.
Yeah, right.
I always think search has been solved.
Yeah.
Clearly not.
But this is the great thing about Gmail, and it's also the great thing about Google Plus, which is everything on Google Plus, everything in Gmail is essentially a search. When you look at your inbox, you're looking at a search result that is kind of set up for you by Google. It's everything with certain attributes. And that's how they go at these things, and it's brilliant. And this is one of the reasons why Google's products like Gmail are so good, because they're rooted in search.
Well, and the key to that, Mike, is it was really revolutionary to think that you didn't kill your email.
Yeah.
Right? Save it.
No, you want to keep your email because you can search it, and you don't need to put it in all kinds of folders and stuff because you can just search it. And so it really took search out of just the web into your life.
Yep.
As I remember, that was one of the selling points. Don't delete any email. Just save it all, and we'll find it. And that was a revelation, although... Now, how is it? 7 gigabytes, 8 gigabytes you get for
free? Now they combine it with Google Drive, and so I have way over 100 gigabytes.
Oh, yeah, I have terrible.
I have 1.1.
Yeah, because we both have pixels.
16.9 gigabytes
of
1.1 terabytes.
Yeah.
Another thing that Time notes, Harry, I should really give Harry credit, Harry McCracken notes in the Time article, is this is probably for most of us the first time we ever used a web app. Unlike Yahoo, Hotmail, and other web pages, this was an interactive app. In fact, really the debut of Ajax to the World Wide Web. Now, I said this on Sunday, and somebody said, Microsoft invented Ajax with ActiveX control. I'm not talking about an ActiveX control. This is the first web app most of us used that you could use on a Windows machine, a Mac, on a Linux machine. It would work if you had a good modern browser. That it wouldn't rewrite the whole page when you opened the Compose window.
Yep.
That was where Ajax came
from. And, of course, most users had no idea about that. All they knew was that when you used Gmail, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, since its beginning, lightning fast. And it just felt so good to use. Because, everything you did was really zippy, and it was really kind of thrilling to use. And I think that most users assumed that it was because they had almost no interface. It was all text and links with no typography. Nowadays, Google's very good with the design. But in the early days, there was a spectacular absence of design of any kind. And it was kind of nerdy for that reason. But the performance was so good that everybody loved it. Or not everybody, but, nerdy types did.
McCracken quotes Buchheit saying, "The ambitious use of JavaScript is another thing most people thought was a pretty bad idea. One of the problems we had was that web browsers weren't very good back then. We were afraid we'd crash browsers and nobody would ever come back." Here's the big story. There were debates within Google whether it should be a paid service. And Buchheit and others, according to McCracken, wanted the service to reach as many people as possible, which was an argument for it being free and supported by advertising. They wanted little unobtrusive text ads with Google search results. Rakowski says, we weren't going to plaster it with banners. We committed to that from pretty early on. But the key was that the ads were keyed to the contents of your email. And I was curious as to whether they knew what a explosive thing that would be. Herrick says in this interview, I'm not sure who Herrick is, or Harik, we thought it pretty hard before doing what we did. We thought, is this thing a perceived privacy violation or a real one? And we decided it would be an issue of perception. So they think they knew that there would be an issue. Yeah. But they also knew that it wasn't a privacy violation because it was just automated.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, they underestimated the reaction of the internet.
They underestimated the action of that. But the funny thing is, and I've told this story before, when Priority Inbox came in, because all they were doing in reading the email was giving you ads. And the truth is, I don't know how much they make from that. I don't even notice the ads on Gmail.
No, I don't see them. Never clicked
Whereas,
on one.
Priority Inbox makes some really critical decisions, obviously, understanding your email and who's important.
Man, nobody mentions
what subjects are important to you.
Right?
And nobody mentions that because the value is so great. In Germany, Google's own programming staff in Munich is a privacy programming staff, and they've taken the brunt of everything about Street View and Buzz and all this stuff. They said, nope, nobody complains even in Germany about Priority Inbox because it's valuable.
I disagree. I think they don't complain because it's not to support advertising. I mean, everybody understands that if you have anti-spam filtering on your service, as everybody does, mostly not as effective as Gmail, but that means that something is reading your mail looking for keywords. So people know that. What they didn't like was that it was tied to advertising, Jeff. I don't think it's... Well...
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, I think that's a really good point in terms of how it ratchets it up. But, I also hear just this general complaint that Facebook knows too much. Of course, everything you tell them.
They know everything, yeah.
they just know too much. They're too big and they know too much. So I hear that kind of generalized Eeyore-ish behavior a lot.
Yeah, I don't think it's because it's tied to advertising. I mean, spam filtering is a clear benefit the reason is because you'd look in your – people who notice the ads, unlike you two who don't notice the ads – just notice that, you know, you're having this conversation about snipe hunting.
Right.
And then you have an ad there for a snipe hunting rifle. Right. And it's like, oh my God, they're tuning into our conversation. It's the creeps factor.
Them out. Right.
And really goes back to search. The way Google looks at it is that they have this huge advertising inventory and then they use the content of your message as the search query. And they surface the most relevant search results within their ad inventory. That's the way they look at it. And they see that that's
their search.
They see that that's their job. If they're going to serve up ads, they want to serve up the most relevant ads possible. And it's a brilliant idea. And it shouldn't freak us out. And no longer does, by the way. We've all gotten used to it. And we've all gone on to be worried about much bigger things. But it shouldn't freak us out because no human being is actually seeing this.
Here's another story I just heard, Mike, that I think that these services could give us more value, but they're scared of doing this. I talked to a journalist the other day who was calling me about a story about privacy, and he told me that he has MS. And on Facebook, in just private messages, he was telling family, boy, you know, I have these weird symptoms. I don't know what's going on. I can't feel my hands. I can't do this. I can't do that. And then suddenly up came ads related to multiple sclerosis. It basically diagnosed him.
Wow.
That's kind of
creepy.
Well, your first reaction, right? Your gut
problematic if they then inform an insurer.
Well, the other, he said the actual problem with it was that they were for grapefruit cures and bad stuff. but the larger point here is that in your communication, there's things about you that you don't know that a smart algorithm could discern that could be of value to you if it's your choice to turn that on. And I think that the Googles of the world have to find ways to find these kinds of individual benefits and give people control over them so that it's not just in Google's benefit, in their view, that it's in people's benefit. But you're going to have exactly what Leo's reaction was, which is the... It's creepy.
The response from the world was quick and very angry. Remember, this came out April 1st. 2004. On April 6th, 31 organizations and advocates co-signed a letter to Larry Page and Sergey Brin, raising a gaggle of concerns about Gmail, calling it a bad precedent, and asking the service be suspended until their concerns could be addressed. This is the quote: "Scanning personal communications in the way Google is proposing is letting the proverbial genie out of the bottle." California State Senator Liz Figueroa sent Google a letter calling it a disaster of enormous proportions for yourself and all of your customers, and then went on to draft a bill requiring any company that wanted to scan an email message for advertising purposes get the consent of the person who sent it.
And so let's now look back, folks. Yes, Armageddon was torture. 2005 was absolute torture. There was no privacy in the world. Everything fell apart. Oh, my God. Everyone was running naked through the streets. No, nothing happened. It was okay. It was fine. We figure it out. If Google had screwed everyone and done something horrible, they would have lost business. Yep. They're too smart for that. Bukhite is the same guy who proposed don't be evil.
Do you think that people widely know that Gmail scans your mail? That's pretty well known, is it not?
I think it's pretty well known. But, you know, I was just looking through some mail. I find it very hard to find an email that of mine that has any ad on it.
Yeah, mine tend to not have ads. And yeah. I wonder about that.
I think they back down, frankly, a little bit. Not completely, but a little bit.
Because I don't think there's much of a market for it. I think that's the real issue. Because I don't think the ads perform.
Advertisers want it. They have to want it for it to be. The point is that 425 million people actively use Gmail now.
Yeah.
Almost half a billion people actively use Gmail. Obviously, I mean, if you assume maybe even only 50% know about this scanning, obviously people have voted.
One of the things that Google does, the big companies like Google and Apple do for a living, is they build a better user. And by that I mean they are trying to change our thinking and our behavior.
That's really
and
nice,
they're
Mike.
Always edging toward where we're going. And this is a perfect example. But I always wonder about people who complain about contextual advertising. Advertising has a bad rap for two reasons. One is that in the Mad Men days, when there were three channels on TV and television advertising was the leading type of advertising, they had to manufacture desire. They had to tell you what you wanted because there was no way to know what you wanted. And so advertising did and should get a bad reputation because they're always sort of trying to manipulate you into buying products you wouldn't otherwise want. The other reason is that advertising tends to grow and go in new places where it hasn't been before. People, you know, tattoos on people's faces, like billboards, every surface is covered with advertising. This is bad, and this is one of the reasons advertising is bad. Contextual advertising in your Gmail is good because it will show you things you want. It won't show you weight loss creams and tampons. It'll show you stuff that you probably really are interested in. Now, the biggest problem with it right now is that nobody is good at it yet, not even Google. Facebook is terrible at it. They show you stuff that you don't want. They show you stuff you've already bought. You know, it's horrible, but the idea is a great idea. It should get to the point where it's like, hey, every ad is like, oh, I want that. Great. There's a great price for it. Click. Buy it. That's good. We do buy things. We do want things. And so I think that in general, the complaints against contextual advertising is totally misplaced. I think that's one of the good types of advertising.
I agree. And not only that, but I know of news companies that spend a lot of effort to contextually advertise and serve ads to you, but don't do the same thing with content. And I'm screeds about that these days. And Standard, you've heard say on the show before, Google knows where I live and where I work. My newspaper doesn't. My newspaper gives me the same 300 to 500 pieces of content it gives everybody else in the world, exactly the same as if I'm a member of a mass. It needs to know me as an individual and serve me with greater relevance. And so the skills that we bring to advertising, actually, to some extent, we now have to bring to content.
Well, that's really, you know, I had the same conversation in a more hostile environment on Sunday with Twit, because both John C. Dvorak and Jolie Odell, I always want to call her Angelina Odell, Jolie Odell, both feel like, there's all sorts of...
Jolie was practically crawling into a cave.
Well, she actually at one point retired from the internet, but then found out that her job as a managing editor at VentureBeat required the use of the internet. So she changed her tune. Thank goodness.
Remember, it was the publisher, not VentureBeat.
The publisher said, you really you gotta be on the internet. You do have a choice. You don't have to use Gmail.
You gave a really good defense of the internet to the two of them, I think, on Sunday.
Yeah. I feel like we get so much out of it. I do want targeted ads.
Yeah.
And I'm inspired by you, Jeff, because you're the one who's hammered this into my brain. You know, this is moral panic. This is what might happen should the government get this or insurers get this or whatever.
Well, but that's the great example that you just had from the time from Harry's piece, is that all the cries, this is disaster. What Gmail is doing is disastrous. I have to pass a law to stop this right now. I have to say stop the entire service because this is so terrible. That's techno panic.
Yeah. And the final point on this is that what a success Gmail is, not merely a number of customers, but can you name another app that you still use basically unchanged? And this is the point that many of the developers made with Harry. It's pretty much the same code for 10 years.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of apps like that where you just could, you know, it's worked and worked well for 10 years. They built it right. They built it to last, and it has scaled like crazy.
And its competitors, like Hotmail, have completely reintroduced totally new apps, totally new sites. And this one, they haven't. They haven't had to. But at the same time, they've upgraded it for the modern world.
I like the new features, many of the new features a lot.
Right.
Still fairly ugly.
Harry was singing the praises of it, and I've always thought it was too many buttons, too difficult to use. I never really quite understood why they called them filters, not folders, but that's that search mentality. Mm-hmm. This is a search, not a folder.
And speaking of filters, I'm complete. I can't leave Gmail now because I have so many filters holding back the ocean of spam and you know, if I were to ever go without those filters, I just couldn't function.
Well, and the other thing that they've done really well is it is of all the email services I use, the only one that really stops the ocean of spam.
Yep.
And they've really nailed that.
Anything with Dr. Oz in it gets through, though. I don't know why.
They think you like him.
I think some, you know, the world is trying to tell me I need to lose weight or something because I get a weight loss.
We talked on the changelog last week about the new promotions tab, and I applied then, and I finally got it. This is what it looks like now. Remember, if you use the primary mailbox, and by the way, the priority mailbox inbox didn't work quite well for me, but these tabs, social updates and forums.
I never did them, and so I forgot
them. I like them, and now this is promotions.
How do I get them? I don't even know.
It's a setting. It turns the promotional emails, all of which these are not spam because there's newsletters. I said okay to things like that. Turns them into kind of a Pinteresty magazine layout, which makes them a lot easier to scan. Yes, I know they are for the most part bacon. Mm-hmm. Which is spam I signed up for.
Sure.
But I can go through it quickly. It doesn't bother me as much. And the fact that it's not in my primary inbox really solves a problem for me. I think this Gmail's gotten better and better and better.
Jeff, it's the gear icon and then choose configure inbox. I tried the tabs.
You don't
tabs.
Like it?
I don't like
Neither
it.
Neither of you are using that.
I don't like it. I really tried hard to like it.
You don't use it, Chad, either.
I love it.
Yeah, me too.
It's the only way that I can manage my inbox because
if it gets to primary, it's almost always
a person.
Primary, person.
Right.
And if it goes by accident to one of the others, I just make it primary. And then it really, and vice versa. And it really, I have a lot of filters. As you see, I have a lot of folders. Mm-hmm. I actually usually use a desktop client, Apple's mail client, to read this because I fetch it from Gmail.
Yep.
So it has its own rules and folders. But this works. In fact, frankly, when I need to see what's in my inbox quickly, I don't go to my Apple mail. I go to this. I go to the interface on the web.
I'm a former fan of Getting Things Done, the book.
Yes,
and
former.
I veered so far away from the whatever. But it's I use my inbox as my one trusted place where I put things. And so I want one trusted place for everything. I don't want three or whatever. So I just use, I don't want promotions. I don't want the things that are in the other tabs.
You don't have to look at them.
Well, that bugs me. Maybe I'm anal retentive or something, but it bugs me to know that they're there. I want them to not be there.
I'm confused.
And I'm also a zero inbox guy.
We've ruined Jeff's mail now.
Yes, you have. Oh. So I did it. Now my priority inbox is gone. Now I don't have the important and everything
else. Oh, no, it doesn't do priority inbox. It does primary instead.
Oh, screw that. That's off.
I hope
you can
turn it back off.
Look at the benefit. You don't have to any priority inbox email to worry about.
They've deprecated priority inbox.
Just don't worry about it, Jeff.
Oh, it's going to be okay.
No, it's gone.
Is it gone?
I can't get it back.
You can get your priority inbox back.
Yeah, all you have to do is hover over your inbox, and then on the right side, there's a drop down, and just choose priority inbox at the bottom.
There it is. I see it. You can show mine, Chad. That's okay.
Chad, you saved my life.
You're welcome.
Inbox type. And then it says, try them all, keep what fits. So you can have default, which is what I'm using. Important first. See, I want them in chronological order.
Me too.
Unread first, starred first, or Jeff's Fakatka priority inbox.
Priority inbox is the, I think beyond spam, priority inbox is the brilliant thing. The miss rate, when I look down at everything else, the things that I ever want in there are nil. And it's not just bacon. It's stuff people I don't pay attention to.
Right.
I use the star feature, the starring email, and I have filters that automatically star certain things to determine what goes into Google Glass and what doesn't. That's all I use it for.
Aren't you the super user?
Yes.
Oh, my.
Yes. Glass hole number one right here.
Unfortunately, you can't combine the tabbed interface with the priority inbox.
Yeah, because priority inbox is the lifesaver for me. Anything that does that.
It's funny to hear you say that because I could never get behind it because I was so afraid that it would use an algorithm that would miss something. And that's why I love the tabs.
Do it for Chad. I'm telling you, do it for a week and you will be amazed.
The moment that an email from my grandmother is sent to away because I didn't check
the everything else. No, just don't check the everything
it.
Else.
But that's an extra step. If it's in the tabs at the
this
top,
works perfectly. Twitter goes to social, YouTube goes to social. Promotion is bacon. Updates is exactly what I expect.
I'm totally in Leo's camp. Like I feel like these are two different products for two different types of people. Me and Leo are one type, and you and Mike Elgin are another.
Leo's an old fart. Don't be a young fart.
That's what I am.
Wait a minute.
It's like
Chad and I are the young farts. You guys are the old farts.
I'm telling you, I trust the algorithm more. I trust the algorithm for priority inbox.
This is a better algorithm.
I don't think it's an algorithm. All it's doing is categorizing, and you're never going to miss anything because it's still going into the folder. I don't trust algorithms. That's why I like Twitter over Facebook. I followed people because I want to see what they write. I don't want Facebook to do its stupid Facebook algorithm.
This old fart likes the new way.
Good.
I'm just telling you.
Good.
I'm using the new fart filter. And it takes care of everything for me.
We're going to take a break. Mike Elgin is here, ably filling in for Gina Trapani, who has the day off. And Jeff Jarvis as well. We're talking about Google, Facebook, the cloud, and more. Lots more to talk about. No change log, though, because without Gina, it wouldn't be a change log. So we'll just have to leave that for next week. Our show today is brought to you by 99 Designs. Actually, that's such a bad name because there's so many more than 99 designs. It's an unlimited number of designs. Look, the world deserves to be a better looking place. And if you're a restaurateur or you're a plumber or you're a web designer, a website guy or an app guy, a gal, don't do your own design. Just, a tip. So many people think they can both cook and design, program and design. Designers, it's a different breed. They're not really human. They're a new species. They have aesthetic sense. They could tell mauve from purple. You know what I'm saying?
They use Macintoshes.
They know what kerning is.
My theory, Leo, is there is no such thing as mauve. It is a color made up by women to fool men.
That's why you should not do your own design. Right there. Right there.
Well, you're right. I need mauve protection from 99 Designs.
If you don't know what kerning is, don't do it. And you should go to 99 Designs. There's a designer waiting to help you. Actually, there's 291,742 designers there waiting to help you. The way it works, you put up a design contest. That is, you say, hey, look, I need a menu. You say something about what you're looking for. Then designers will submit ideas to you. You go through them, you refine them, you pick the one you want, and you pay an often very affordable price, as low as $199. Right now, if you go to 99designs.com, you'll see there are 2,280 open contests. They have paid out, and sometimes people say, well, come on, does anybody get paid? They've paid out $2.2 million last month to designers. So designers, this is a great way for designers to get work and a great way for you to get a great design. This is how we did our Twit hoodies. We've been doing a lot of stuff at 99 Designs. In fact, we got so many great designs for the Twit hoodie. We bought five of them. We made the hoodie. We're going to make some T-shirts and other things. Wouldn't it be great if you could start your next design project right now, have dozens of designers to choose from in just a few days? Selection, speed, creativity, just a few of the benefits of having these designers work on your project. When you launch a design contest, you'll get lots of ideas. You'll give the designers feedback. You end up with a perfect design within a week. The process is fun, fast, and 100% satisfaction guaranteed. So do me a favor. Go to 99designs.com/twig and get a $99 power pack of services free. A power pack gives you more designer time and attention on your contest. They will bold and highlight and feature your design project in their marketplace. You'll get nearly twice as many submissions. And that's all for free because you went to 99designs.com/twig. Don't kern it yourself. Let a professional do it. You wouldn't do your own open heart surgery. Why
back
would you do your
own
design?
Back away from the font, sir.
Huh?
Back away from the font.
Get a step away from the font. It is. It's really. I have such respect for designers because they have just some sense that is that I don't have that gene.
I heard something amazing yesterday at lunch that IBM is hiring 200 designers a year.
Wow.
That the belief is the technology is going to get easier and easier and easier, and all those CS degrees, but experience and design broadly defined as architecture
fair.
And such.
Yeah.
I think it's very, very important, and young students should be learning more design.
It's unfair. It's unfortunate, somebody like Steve Gibson, an old timer like Steve Gibson, will say this. He hand codes his stuff for it's tight, it's fast, it's small. He writes an assembler. The problem is that programming has become a little bit more of a hack profession because you just throw more power at it. Oh, don't worry about it. There's plenty of memory, plenty of power. And so programming is not the tight
art.
Craft and art that it was, but design still is. So, and UI still is. You know, that stuff still is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to get some nasty emails from programmers, but...
I remember back in the day, I used to work on these things called Coyote terminals from a company called SII way back in the newspaper days. And what a huge deal it was when somebody wrote H&J, hyphenation and justification, to fit inside a terminal. This was just beyond belief. Genius to be able to, it was like haiku to get that in there so that you could decide where to put the hyphen in a word. Wow.
We were looking... where was that? Was that Mac Brickley? Woz's original schematics and designs for the floppy drive.
Oh,
and
man.
What an artist he was. That because in those days, every chip, you know, meant it was huge. And he was so proud of the fact that he got the entire design into one chip. I guess it was with Gibson.
Gibson was talking about that.
Just amazing.
Yep. So what happens, we should have Gina here for this too, but when space isn't an issue and code becomes voluminous... Is there an issue to that? Is it all just become messy like my office?
You know, I would guess that half the security issues we see today come from
that
poor
yeah.
programming. Something as simple as using, when you're copying a string into memory, using stir copy instead of stir end copy, where you don't check the size of the string. Sloppy programming or the assumption that, well, we don't need to worry because we got lots of RAM. That's where you get these buffer overflows that are a huge problem. So, yeah, sloppy programming leads to bad security. Absolutely. Just look at go to fail. That's all you have to look at. One other thing Google has added, but not to Gmail on the desktop, but Gmail for Android. Apparently, according to Engadget, they're considering allowing you to snooze and pin messages.
I love that. I need to snooze messages. I do it. I use something called Follow Up Then. Have you ever heard that? But it's a very simple way to make things go away and then come back later. And it would be nice to just be able to do it in the app. I'd like to see this on the desktop, too.
According to Geek.com, Google's testing an army of new features for Gmail. They always do, and that's why I always look in the labs to see what's there. Pinning would make it sticky, right? So it would never go away.
What's snoozing? I don't get snoozing.
It just something comes in, you want to deal with it day after tomorrow, so you just basically say go away for 2 days. And then it comes back in your inbox.
It doesn't stay in your inbox. It reappears in your inbox.
Right. I would assume that that's what it is.
I've got a problem here, Mike. When it rolls off the screen, I'm screwed.
Right.
If I don't deal with it.
You'd love snoozing.
So I think I would. But then what's going to happen is I can see it. I have this picture in my mind of 3,000 emails at my window like
fogging the window.
Let me in, let me in.
Right, right. Yeah, this is bad. I don't know.
Well, that's getting things done, right, is the idea that you don't, you know.
Right.
You could defer
Here's
it.
Here's the tyranny of email. The tyranny of email is that the sender controls, not the recipient. Bob Wyman at Google taught me that lesson years ago.
Right.
And well, once the sender controls, it's screwed. You know, you think about it, it's actually pretty rude to send somebody a message and expect them to respond. Just like it would be rude to just show up out of nowhere at your front door and knock on the door and expect them to answer and let you in.
That's email?
Who's to say? That's email.
Well, remember, now that's a little more authentic because remember, people didn't want the telephone in the house because it would ring it.
Yeah.
And you couldn't stop it. So I guess,
imagine a bell in your house that anyone in the world could ring off at any time for free.
Actually, that's a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea.
Wasn't it, Chad, weren't you saying that you like sleep with your phone and answer things in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Jeez. No, so what all good Android phones do this. The Moto X has a do not disturb. Mm-hmm. That you could set either for a time or when we're in a meeting or you know, you could say, don't ring the phone. I use Do Not Disturb. The HTC One, it's not quite as elegant as the Moto X, but there's a Do Not Disturb. And I've actually written a schedule 7 days a week for what times I don't want this phone to ring. And some of it's when I'm sleeping. Mm-hmm. Some of it's when I'm on the air.
That's, how are you with the HTC versus – because you love the Moto X.
I did, and I'm going to talk about it at the end of the show.
Okay, fine.
It'll be my pick of the week this week. What's the latest with Turkey? Mike, I know you cover this on TNT every day, yep. And it seems to be an automatically updating story. The prime minister of Turkey got a little upset with social media, and he started blocking Twitter. So the graffiti on the walls of Turkey had Google's DNS 8.8.8.8. So you could just basically, instead of using the officially broken Turkish DNS, use Google's. But now that's not working anymore.
That's right. What they did was, so first they blocked Twitter, then the viral campaign. Then Turkey blocked Google DNS and some of the other DNS services. And then they did something pretty astonishing. They spoofed it. So they had the actual DNS servers were in Germany and other countries. They spoofed it so that at the ISP level, any attempt to go to some of the major, Google Public DNS or some of the major competitors to that would be rerouted to a fake DNS page within Turkey at the telecom level. And this not only prevented people from going to YouTube and Twitter, but it also enabled them to harvest the IP addresses and so on and essentially spy on whoever it is was trying to use this service. So it's really an astonishing thing because this kind of thing has only been done at the large scale by the Chinese government, but not in this exact way. This is the first use of this particular approach to spoofing it, and it's called it's called DNS tampering. The first time it's ever state sponsored DNS tampering has ever taken place, and so
really?
At this level in this particular way because of the way they're doing it, and so it's really it's the horrible thing about it, it's really effective. It's really a great idea if you're trying to control information to hijack essentially the thing that people are using to get around your block.
But here's a question, Mike. So because of the graffiti, Turkey knows that 8888, everybody's going to that. But they can't control like every DNS, or can they make every single DNS in the country go to their DNS?
They're doing the major ones. So they've hijacked, there are two by Google, there's level 3 DNS and open DNS are the big ones. So they're, you know, they're going after 80% or 90% of the usage. And of course, what they're really tapping into is they're tapping into the viral information about, you know, people are sharing it and saying, hey, everybody go use this. And then they're tapping into that information.
Right.
And then they're going after it.
So which is what I feared when I saw the graffiti on the streets saying go to 8888, that, you're just saying to the government, okay, we know what to block.
Yeah.
The idea that if there were an explosion of good DNSs around the world that people in Turkey could go to, does it become a game of whack-a-mole for the Turkish government then?
It would be. The problem is that they're both playing it for the masses essentially, and the masses are going to be slow to find these more obscure services. So it's really a question of communication. Plus, there's a lot of censorship in Turkey anyway over porn and things like that. So they've really got quite an infrastructure to tamp down on this. Now, the government itself is divided as well. So it's really a problem, and it's probably going to lighten up after their election, which I think is in a couple of days or something. But this is a really ham-fisted attempt.
Once you figure out how to do this, it's tempting just to keep it up, right? That's the problem with this. Yeah. It's a slippery. Oh, we'll only do this till after the election, and then of course, they keep doing it. I asked Vint Cerf about this specifically. And also about the move to end the U.S. Department of Commerce's contract with ICANN and this whole notion of the internet, somebody controlling the internet. He says control is a funny word. You can't really use the word control when it comes to the internet. But what he did say is the extremities, the endpoints of the internet can be controlled. Within a nation, you can control the internet. Or your internet service provider can act inappropriately with regard to net neutrality. But the internet itself heals itself, protects itself, is designed to not to be susceptible to this kind of stuff. So no one can, Turkey can't screw up our internet, but they can screw up their own internet.
That's right.
Yeah. And because that's interesting.
Yeah, because the government, you know, the ISPs are just companies that have to function with permission by the government, theoretically. And China has done, you know, if you're going to be a connoisseur of fine authoritarian
internet. They're good
at
that. The great firewall of China.
They have multiple things. They have the great firewall of China. They really go after the intelligentsia. They don't worry about the bumpkins and the countryside and so on, but they really crack down on, you know, the eastern side of the country and the southern part of the country. They have this 50-cent army where they have just huge numbers of people out there just saying nice things about China and criticizing anybody who criticizes Chinese policy. Plus, they have huge numbers of internet censors on social media. So they're censoring social media, Twitter-like sites and Facebook-like sites, painstakingly, huge numbers of people going through all these messages and just blocking and ratting out people. And just it's a daily
and on top of
constant,
all of that,
yeah,
they have intimidation.
Yes.
Those are all the known and seen things, even though we don't know exactly how many, but the those are the explicit activities of censorship. But there's the more heinous implicit activity of censorship, which is government intimidation.
That's right. And combined, all of that combined is what makes their control information so effective, essentially.
Yeah. My thought has always been, this: you're going to see this in localized areas. But it also hurts the country so much in terms of, because the internet really is about free communication. It's good for a country. That's why we want to preserve the internet. It's good for innovation. It's good for consumers. It's good for commerce. It's good for so much stuff that you only do this at your own peril. So I believe ultimately that the Chinese government will back down on this because ultimately it's not good for China. China wants to be a part of the global community.
But the Chinese Communist Party, which controls the government, doesn't. What they're concerned about is other political parties entering in and participating in their government. And that's really, it's the same thing in Turkey. It's a political party doing this to defend itself against another political party. So you don't really have democracy in most countries. You might not have it in any country, but in places like China and to a certain extent Turkey, you have political parties who are competing with other political parties and using censorship.
So the party can control it.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's bad for the country. And if it's bad for the country, it's ultimately bad for the party. And, you know, of course, you're going to have totalitarian regimes. Yeah. Those aren't good for people in any respect. But I think that the internet is a great threat to those in the long run. And it's just, I feel like it is such a democratizing power.
It absolutely,
and the people always seem to get around these things.
Well, as they're learning in Turkey. I mean, in Turkey, Turkey is a functioning democracy, and the party doing this is just going to get hammered.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just in addition to the fact that they were committing the censorship to cover up some apparent graft and so on. But in China, it's a different story. There is no alternative political party in China, so that's a different story. However, what we're really learning,
and there's no history of democracy.
That's right.
In China,
yeah. But what they're really learning in Turkey is you can't do this. It doesn't work at all. It makes you a laughing stock. It brings attention to the things you're trying to hide. We're sitting there on this tech show talking about a really inside baseball Turkish political thing. Everybody now knows about this corruption.
It's the Streisand effect. Yeah.
We wouldn't have been talking about Turkish corruption unless they did this. So this is a horrible idea.
Nexus 10 might be coming back soon. A listing on the Google Play Store, maybe that's a mistake, said it's coming
still, it
still
soon. Says coming soon.
Does that mean the old Nexus 10 and they're just going to, they're out of stock?
But it's been gone for some time.
We've been waiting for a long time for a new Nexus 10.
Yeah, they kept the price up there. So you know, if they were going to come up with a new Nexus 10, then you think they would take some details out and just say coming soon.
It's
a bit odd.
It's hard to know what it means when they say coming soon.
Yeah, but it's got to be a new one. It's got to be a revamped
But version. The specs currently are not any different.
It still says 32 yeah. gigs for $499, 16 gigs yeah. for $399.
5-megapixel front. I mean, 5-megapixel main camera and 1.9-megapixel front. Yeah, it seems
funny,
like
I have zero desire for a big tablet anymore.
No, I like my Nexus 7 plenty good.
I'm a 7. Yeah, exactly. My 7 is
yeah, it's just the right size.
Cat's meow.
Google normally, in fact, I gave them a little trouble for this last year. It really goes wild on April Fool's. Do you think they backed down a little bit, that they realized
I think it's even more than that, Leo, because I hate April 1st. I just want it to be April 2nd. I cannot stand it.
Yes.
This year, my Twitter feed had virtually nothing. I didn't see any of the usual stuff. I just think maybe last year was the Armageddon of April 1st, and this year it's calmed down.
Thank God.
It may not just be Google. I do have to say that the Matt Cutts one was cute.
What was the Matt Cutts one?
It's a video. It's a video.
All right, let's.
It's a visual gag.
He's not going to stop changing, and it's a visual gag. So, you probably won't.
For our audio listeners.
For our audio listeners, it's not going to be much fun. But I'll give you the play by play. Here's our much beloved.
We have a question from Dave in the UK. Dave asks, "When will you stop changing things?" Look, I'm sorry, Dave, but I can't do that. The web is always changing. The things that we think we need to do for users will always be changing. So, and of course, spammers and their techniques are always changing. So we're always looking at different
what's
new
happening
ways
is
to try to
shirt
rank results
is just constantly
better.
Changing.
It is. I didn't even notice.
Yeah. Yes. Look. There will nothing else is changing.
It's gray. Violet. It's purple. How do they do that?
I don't know how they did it. It's kind of brilliant.
Based on what its users are looking for.
That's it.
You know,
it's all,
people are starting
Matt
to do more.
Keeps on blathering on and on and on about how we have to change.
I didn't even notice it.
His shirt changes colors. That's it.
Even if we
that's
do
the
a perfect
gag.
Job
that's that. Okay, that's pretty subtle. For Google, subtle. That's very subtle. Let's see what else they got.
I thought the Hasselhoff thing was great.
I got Hoffsomed.
I couldn't get it to happen to me. I wanted it to happen to me. I took a picture so it would happen.
That was kind of the beauty of it, is you can't force the Hoff. And they had a Hoff bot, David Hasselhoff bot, that would, if you mentioned David Hasselhoff in a post on Google+, he would respond. And then I'll show you some of the things that happened to me. Did you see the pictures they Hasselhoffed of me? Let me see if I can find these.
It was awful.
It was awful. So here's some obvious ones. Let me just show you the obvious ones first. The first one that happened to me. What is that, Chad? Who's that?
This is my only Hoff. Hoffsome.
I got three.
Yeah. No.
So here's one. I was testing out the HTC One camera. Took a picture of Jason.
That's pretty funny.
I thought there must be a human doing this because this is too perfect.
It is Jason's looking mournful and the Hoff is looking
like
Hoffish.
Something. And then, but did notice that where it would have the auto awesome mention, it says April Fools.
Yep.
And then this photo was created by adding David Hasselhoff to your photo, which is so random as to be hysterical. And then I got another one because I was testing this camera out a lot. This is John Slanina. Oh, wait a minute. This is a new one.
Yeah, it is.
This is one I hadn't seen before. So there's new stuff because this is the one I saw earlier. So they've put more Hasselhoff in with the Jammer B.
And if the listeners, the viewers want to check out what has happened to other people, you can go to Hoffsome, the hashtag Hoffsome.
You'll see them all.
And you'll see.
But this one was my favorite. And I thought, my God, this has got to be a human. Because you see this chess set here? Zoom in a little bit, and you'll see Hasselhoff is peeking out behind one of the bishops. A little tiny Hasselhoff.
A mini
Hoff. That's some great algorithmic work, man.
Well, and I figured it has to be algorithmic because these are not public photos. So there's no way Google's going to go into my photos with some human's going to go in and modify my photos, right? Yeah. Tell me that. But how do they do that?
Yeah, but, you know, they do some amazing things with computer image recognition. For example, they know the difference between a dog and a cat. They know the difference between a baby and a child.
They know smiles.
They know facial expressions. So they're image recognition algorithms are killer.
I will submit that this is, I got the best Hoffsum.
That is amazing.
Oh, that is killer.
That blows me away.
He's exactly the same size as the chess pieces.
He's a si- and he's peeking out from behind one.
Yeah.
How can a computer know that?
Yeah.
Because the computer has to silhouette the chess piece and have him behind. His hand is behind another chess piece.
Right.
It layered the photo. It layered out the layer of the photo.
In this case, it may have made what they would consider an error. It may have thought those chess pieces were actual people. It may have recognized them as humans and just thought he was putting them into a group photo. But it's brilliant the way it looks. It's perfect. If you were to do this by hand, it would actually be kind of hard.
No, exactly. That's right, Mike.
Wow. That is anyway.
Yeah, the stuff was nothing was really.
Oh, there was one more good one. And I have to pull out my Android. Well, actually, I could show it on Google Plus. Maybe that's the best thing. And I wonder if it's still in here. They added a new translator to Chrome. So if you go to a text page in Chrome, oh, it's gone. Oh, it was only there for one day. How sad. You could translate a page into emoji. I'm glad I captured this. I went to Andy Anatko's blog on the mobile, and I translated it to emoji. And, they should have left that in. I'm so disappointed. And how do they do this without updating Chrome? Maybe I didn't get a Chrome update in either respect.
It's like magic.
These guys at Google are good.
I didn't see some of these Waze dates. Waze will show you a single person ahead.
That's another Hasselhoff looking out from behind people. So maybe I'm not the only one who got that. But are there any other chess sets with Hasselhoff on the board? That's a good one.
It didn't realize that was her hand.
And oh, he's eating her hand.
It caught the edge.
That's Hasselhoff zombie.
Not quite.
Gruesome.
Yeah, it didn't realize the table. Okay, that makes me feel better.
They're flipping off the Hoff.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I didn't even realize the content of
you,
that.
You young people, you're just immune to profanity. Anyway, I thought that was pretty good. That had, but again, we didn't see the massive number of Google April Fool's jokes, and I, for one, am thrilled. And the ones they did
too.
Were pretty good.
I was delighted.
Yeah. They weren't, it wasn't like, remember the toilet internet, and I mean.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, there was one. There was a Pokemon game in Maps that was kind of cool. Google is going to focus on portrait shots and effects by offering a camera app for everyone on the Google Store.
And then you fancy HTC One people won't feel so special.
I'm feeling already ripped off. They're also working on raw support. This is clearly one of the big battlegrounds in smartphones is not just the quality of the camera, but computational photography, taking the photo and modifying it.
Well, they say they're going to be able to do what your new camera does without the second lens.
I know.
They're going to understand depth.
Actually, Nokia does that with their Refocus app, and actually it does a very good job. But we did a review on Before You Buy yesterday. Brian Burnett had the Icon, the 929, and he had a picture of raindrops on a windshield. It did arguably a better job than the HTC One.
Really? Wow.
Well, but the problem is you have to have a Windows phone to use it, and I don't know if I'm willing to give up everything else. Yeah, right.
the important thing, though, I think that companies like Google are realizing that 98% of what people want from their smartphone camera is to take a picture, upload it to social media, and have it be like, wow.
Yeah.
Just have a wow effect.
Instagram. That's what Instagram realized.
And Instagram isn't doing it as well as Google is doing it.
Right.
Really, a Google Plus, the auto filters, the auto modification on Google Plus is really astonishingly good. It's really so good. I take all these lousy pictures with Google Glass, and I'll take multiple and stitch them together and do all kinds of really amazing things. The subtle improvements that it makes. And hopefully this feature of the blurring feature and so on will make it to Google Plus as well, because they have the auto backup thing. So every picture you take just goes right into Google Plus. You can have every picture on your laptop just go right into Google Plus. They'll modify it. You can undo the modification with a single click. It's really, really nice the way they do that, and it's really improving photography. which is great because the Instagram process, Instagram wrecks your pictures, Facebook wrecks your pictures. I've done a lot of side-by-side pictures of what Facebook does to your photographs with its aggressive compression, and this is the direction we want to go in, improvement of pictures rather than denigrating them and making them look lower res and all that kind of stuff.
They are smart. I mean, the combination of Google Plus, a great Android app, it's frankly almost so good that you don't even want to use your camera anymore.
Yeah.
So 4.4.3. I'm sorry. That's not right. That's out. It'll be, I guess, in 4.4.
No, it's good. The camera stuff is supposed to be a separate update from
for
the
everybody.
Next Android update.
And will you have to have a Nexus 5 or?
I don't know.
But increasingly, they've put the Google apps on the Play Store, which is really great for those of us who don't have.
Yeah, I mean, it'll become a default thing in 4.4.3, but in the meantime, they're going to come out with a standalone app, which is great.
Awesome. Yeah. We were up early this morning. It's been a long day, 8 a.m. Actually, you were up early. I got here late. Mike Elgin and Peter Kafka from Recode watched as Amazon revealed a set-top box, the Fire TV, $99. It is Android. It looks like they didn't say the word Android, but it's pretty obviously Android powered.
Android, yeah. Peter Kafka said that he talked to developers.
Said straight out it was Android.
Yeah, it's just Amazon didn't say it, but of course it's just like the Kindle, and it will have a quad core processor. They didn't name the processor and a dedicated GPU, and that's important because unlike the Roku and the Apple TV, well, Roku has some gaming, but this is going to be significantly a larger amount of gaming. In fact, Amazon has a game studio they've put together. It will have all of the requisite Netflix, obviously Amazon streaming, Hulu Plus, they mentioned, Vivo, I think they mentioned. So it's another streaming box, and it's the same price as the Apple TV and the Roku.
Yes, with some benefits. One of them is that it's an Xbox-like game controller that you
can
buy.
For an additional $40.
Yes, but to play casual and mobile-style games as opposed to, Call of Duty and so on. The other thing that I think is kind of a killer feature for parents is this parental kind of thing. You can sign your kids up for all-you-can-eat content.
Free, isn't it? Is it free?
No,
it's a special paid channel.
Yes. All right. And they already have it for tablets, for the Kindle Fire, and there are parental controls and all that kind of stuff, but now they're extending it to the TV. So now if you have, small children, you don't want to expose them to the horrors of TV commercials, you can sort of turn them loose on this. They get to choose their own content, and it's a great idea. And they're we don't really pay a lot of attention to this because it's like children's culture, to a certain extent. But this is really, they really are hitting it hard in the same way that McDonald's did with playgrounds and Ronald McDonald and all that kind of stuff. Which really the secret sauce for McDonald's is you get small children loving your brand, and then it becomes a lifelong.
They're hooked.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so this is a big. And they're kind of under the radar because who else is really targeting children so aggressively with
this? That's a good point. Plus, there's the voice command stuff, which I don't know if that's a gimmick or not.
A lot of things have voice command. I was pointing out that my television, my Samsung TV, has a remote control with a microphone. Of course, the Xbox One is a voice command. This is not unusual.
But overall, performance is something they're touting and saying, everything's zippy. The voice search is very fast, they say. And we'll see the reviews. And, of course, you're going to hopefully
Here's
do
a question
unboxing
about that,
soon.
Mike.
I'll have one tomorrow.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to be here tomorrow, but I guess I'm coming in. You know what? I'll tell you what, Mike. It's coming here. Mm-hmm. If a box from Amazon arrives here to me, you have my permission to open it and demo it.
Okay.
That's for you.
Great.
So with any luck, we'll have it on TNT, if Fantastic. Not on Tech News Tonight.
Here's a question. After the Netflix was it Comcast deal? When you stream to the Amazon box, are they going to have to be paying peering fees to make it perform well?
That's a very interesting question. I mean, probably not. Roku doesn't, but Netflix does and gets the benefit
on
Netflix Roku.
When Netflix goes to the Amazon box, does that look to Comcast like it's Amazon or Netflix?
It's Netflix. Now, Netflix. That's what's, I believe, but that's what's different about the Apple TV. Is that the Apple TV, Apple has its own CDN, and all content on the Apple TV comes from from Apple CDNs.
Yep.
I believe they use Akamai. Right. So that's very pricey for Apple But it gives a much better user experience, even if you're on Comcast.
Yep.
Prior to the deal.
Yep. And Amazon, and that brings up another thing that Amazon is doing, which is that they have a recommendation engine. So at any given time, they say, based on what you've watched so far, probably based on what the books you've ordered and things like that, here are the TV shows we think you're going to like, and it starts to download them in advance. So when you choose one, it just plays instantly.
We know you're going to want to see this.
And here we go. Ooh,
I'll tell you what you are going to want to see, this crazy Gary Busey ad. Is Gary Busey actually crazy? Or is he just making?
He has some. I believe he has some brain damage from a motorcycle accident.
He does, but he's also just.
Well, he's making hay on it. I mean, he was on. What was it, Entourage, where he appeared and was absolutely cray cray?
He mostly plays himself.
If you're like me, you like talking to things.
Hello, lamp.
Hello, Gary.
See? Hello, pants.
Maybe the weirdest ad a major American company has ever made.
Thank you, Fish, for being here.
I wonder if that's really his house.
But it's frustrating when things don't listen, especially high-tech things. Find Gary Busey.
Find Gary Busey!
But this new Amazon Fire TV listens to me and does exactly what I say. Gary Busey.
So you press and hold the button.
Yay! Amazon Fire TV!
Well, it definitely gets your attention.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Why do they pick on Roku specifically?
But that's the direct competition. And
I know, but it's kind of...
The truth is, this is just another, you know, it's a Me Too product. I submitted, but I think I was wrong, that maybe this was just Amazon saying, well, we got to get at the starting point so that we are equal to all these other companies, so that when the big deals come down the pipe that, you know, we can basically replace cable, we want to be there.
Yeah, I think the streaming boxes are going to get much more compelling this year, and I think they're afraid that people who are using their streaming services are going to say, you know what, I don't need Amazon anymore because I get better deals with this other box. Now they have a box with games, and you know, they're hitting all the high points and a couple of vaguely unique features is enough to keep people and keep growing. They bragged at the beginning of the event of how fast they've grown and so on, and they want to keep that going, and they want to sort of hold off the competition. And who knows? You know, I think the real play here ultimately, as we were saying on the broadcast this morning, is they want to get people using their TV to shop, to engage with Amazon content, to see advertisements and promotions on Amazon, to, you know, cross-pollinate across the various Amazon things.
It's not a big market, remember.
Tablets.
I mean, the total, if you include Apple TV, Roku, and all of these set-top boxes, well under 20 million units.
Mm-hmm. How about the...
And Google, which entered this market and has left it. I mean, the Chromecast is something completely different. It's almost as if Google thought about it and said, you know what? Nobody really wants this. What they want is media. Yeah, you like the Google TV, Chet. I like the Google TV, but it's dead.
Yeah, I know. But it's one of the reasons I wore this shirt today because
you knew.
I knew the Amazon announcement thing. It was just like, hey, Amazon, don't forget that.
But the Chromecast.
It's hard space.
The Chromecast is a different idea. The idea that it's whatever's on your smartphone or your computer or your Chromebook, Jeff. Can be sent to the TV, and that really the responsibility for it lies in the device sending it to the Chromecast. Yeah. If
so
you want voice, you do it on the device, right?
I'm happy with Chromecast. I don't know why I just bought the Amazon box.
Oh, you bought it too, huh? Yeah, I was bemoaning the fact that I'd have to buy it just to review it. I don't want it.
I'm canceling it.
Last thing I need is another thing attached to my TV.
I don't know.
They
certainly have the means to market the crap out of it. And I know that people will, you know, Amazon has some real fans. People love Amazon. They love the Prime service, the shipping and all that kind of stuff. And this is a way for them to leverage that kind of fandom.
Sure.
You can imagine little pop-ups popping up and saying your package is going to arrive in the next 10 minutes. And, you know, weird stuff like that. Amazon is moving to having their own trucks.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But there are a lot of opportunities everywhere.
Stop watching the Americans. Your packages arrived. would be interesting.
And that's the other thing. There's data. There's a lot of data here. And they'll be able to look at people's habits. They'll be able to, you know, remember, this is a company that not only came out with a tablet, but its own Silk web browser.
Right.
Because they want to harvest data, that more and more data. And they were the original data harvesting company. Their book recommendations in the early days was the first real glimpse we saw of the world of contextual marketing and advertising, essentially. Because they said, hey, you're going to love this book. And you're like, how do they know? That's exactly the book that I would love.
Right.
And they do it through these algorithms and so on. And they just want a lot more data.
If you're paranoid, this is just another device watching what you do.
That's right.
In your house.
They can deliver the Washington Post right to your TV.
I do wish, I keep waiting for, yeah, right, because we own it. I do wish that that flood of Chromecast apps that we keep expecting would happen.
Yeah.
There's more coming. Haven't there been in the last 2 weeks?
Yes. Yahoo wants to capture YouTube, a little of the YouTube glitter, by luring YouTube stars over to a new video service, presumably that they're creating. This is according to Recode. And they'll give you more money if you do it. They haven't come to me yet. I'm a YouTube star. Oh, no, I'm not a YouTube star. There's the problem.
What do you mean you're not a YouTube star?
Oh, God. What is our total downloads on YouTube? 5,000?
Because you have your own YouTube.
All right.
I need to start. Chad and I both tried to figure this out. Chad wants to be a YouTube star. I know that. I know that fact. Chad's crazy because he ain't going to make any money on a YouTube, but maybe the
Well, there's a lot of people. The thing is, I was watching something. Jim Lauterbach had a talk about, can you make a business on YouTube? And he had a whole panel about it with all the people.
Of course he thinks so. Revision 3, that was their model.
At the end, the panel was no.
No.
You at the moment, you can't create a business on YouTube. I think that individuals can create a business for themselves.
Barely. With a lot of work, you might make $100,000 a year.
With a lot of work, you might be working
50 hours, 60 hours, 70 hours a week, and you make $100,000 a year. You're not going to get rich.
Somebody like Marcus Brownlee.
Right. But
he is the exception that proves the rule. I'm sure MKBHD pulls in, six figures.
Right. Right,
I'd pay him six figures to work here, and he wouldn't have to be editing all the time.
But the point,
he wouldn't be able to.
He wouldn't be his own thing.
He wouldn't be his own thing.
But I think I think that's a lie that's being told and propagated right now, not by Google because I don't think they need to. But just that's the notion that you can become a rich YouTube star if you just make videos in your kitchen.
Right. It's everybody talks about Marcus Brownlee, and even his success, and he's one success story. Who you have to compare against a million less success people.
Well, same
successful
with blogs.
People.
Right. That's not a bad thing.
Right. But the point is that even his income is very.
He deserves more.
Well, he could get less. If you know, when you succeed in an environment like that, there are going to be 100 imitators.
Right.
The market, the economics of advertising in an environment like that are just completely unpredictable. And they always tend downward toward less and less valuable. And there's such a glut of content on YouTube. It's not anything you can really build a business on. You can't really count on it because you can't control the market. If there's another recession or something like that, you just never know what's going to happen. It's not a good, reliable business model. It's great if you're in college, you know, making a ton of money, and you can buy a convertible, and it's great. But it's really not a good place to build a business.
I gotta say, I really as much as I poo-poo this, I still think YouTube is a million years better than mainstream. Hello, is that me or?
Yeah, it's on your computer.
Oh my god,
your phone will ring here in just a second.
You know what? The problem is Hangouts. Now everybody knows my Hangout address. So, did you see the story on Tesla on 60 Minutes? So once again, mainstream media. Let me play this. See if I can get this video going here.
Well, if you play it, we're gonna hear Hangout music.
I don't know where that's coming from. I don't have a Hangout open.
We can just do the audio.
Whoops, I just closed everything.
That'll fix it.
Nothing's making noise. Let me pull that up again. So apparently 60 Minutes did a story on the Tesla in which they added car sounds because it was too quiet. It was too quiet. And 60 Minutes even admits this. They said, well, it was an editing error. BS, an editing error. You can't tell me that's an editing error.
Whoops, we accidentally had
a moment. How did you figure you were going to start a car company and be successful at it? Well, I didn't really think Tesla would be successful.
I feel like 60 Minutes is the laughingstock of all.
It shouldn't be. It's our most prestigious television news.
That's CNN.
CNN's the laughingstock. By the way, let's switch to CNN. Oh, that jet's still missing. Okay, thank you.
We still know nothing.
But let's talk about it.
But in a semi-related story, the EU has just ruled that all electric cars have to make artificial. Engine noise.
That's because French people like to wander in the streets.
Miles on a charge.
Is that why?
And Musk is building a network of charging stations where the driver pays nothing for a fill-up.
Do we miss this?
He hopes to make the stations largely solar-powered one day.
You can drive for free forever on pure sunlight. That's
at the end.
You know, message we're trying to convey. So even if like this is
awesome, it's still a great ad for Tesla.
Yep.
Breaks down.
Oh. But come on, you don't have to add car noise.
I bet this will be like he's going to drive into the future.
No, I guess it was over here somewhere. That looks like Google's charging
station.
That's the superchargers.
Right before that,
250 miles
there.
On a charge.
Right there.
That's not what it sounds like.
50 miles on a charge.
Or it's the sound of the chase car with the camera on it.
Tesla will go about 250 miles on a charge. And Musk is building a network of charging stations.
That's indeed. That's there you go. Thank you, 60 Minutes, for that. In my day, you didn't edit footage and add sound effects to it. I think. Maybe we did. I just forgot.
Did you cry on camera?
Yeah. What was
broadcast
that?
News.
Who was
broadcast
that?
Broadcast News.
Broadcast News. That's right.
Yeah.
That was a movie. That wasn't real, right?
No.
Okay.
Well, it's more real than CNN these days. I rarely do this, but I wrote a spoof post, not April 1st, just saying that they were going to rebrand CNN the Missing Network.
Yeah, I saw that. And you're right on.
They cover missing people. Jesus. CNN's been disgusting me.
Well, I mean, obviously they found out that people want to think about this jet 24/7. It's seems to be the only story they're covering. There was a really good piece on Wired by an amateur pilot that I actually think is the true story. And I don't know they want to think space aliens.
Black holes.
Now they're saying it's a criminal investigation. But this piece in Wired seemed pretty straightforward. The guy's a pilot. He said, well, first thing I saw when this plane took this hard turn, I looked to see what was on that trajectory. It's the nearest landing strip that has enough sufficient capacity to land at 777. He said, as a pilot, of course, one of the things you always keep in mind, always keep in the back of my mind is, should anything go wrong, where's the nearest place I can land?
They train you to do that every minute you say, where do I land?
That's your job. So he says, what it seems likely is there was a fire. You know, there have been several cases of fires and tires and then working their way up through the plane fuselage, taking out the electrical system sequentially. He says it makes perfect sense that once the fire was detected, they immediately made that turn towards a safe landing place. And he believes that they then were overcome by smoke inhalation and the plane continued on its course until it ran out of fuel and crashed.
Yep.
That makes no sense.
To CNN.
Slate said this makes no sense either. So, okay. I guess we're now succumbing to this.
If you go to CNN right now, guess what they're talking about?
Oh, no, I have it in my office. And it's almost comical. It's all they'll talk about. All right.
I think it's in Al Capone's vault.
And the problem is, it's a tragedy.
It's right? a terrible tragedy.
It's a terrible tragedy. It's a real tragedy. There are real lives. And it's being exploited. And
by the way, the Google connection of the Goodfellow story in Wired is that he used Google Earth to find out where that plane was headed.
I think the bigger issue with news, just coverage like this, is that it used to be for a while the mistake that network news organizations made was that the amount of coverage they spent on a story was how big of a story it was. That to me is kind of a mistake. You want to, if there's no information, you shouldn't be spending hours on a story with everybody tap dancing and making stuff up. But now it's like instead of what's the most newsworthy thing, it's what's the most salacious or what's the most
totally ratings driven,
and it's the problem is that you attract more people, but they're people who don't buy stuff, like from a business model. They're trying to, like, you know, boost their advertising and so on. But people who spend the whole day hearing people speculate about black holes swallowing the airplane are not going to buy the home shopping the Lexus you're advertising. Right.
Microsoft Build conference going on in San Francisco. Our Build coverage is going to really happen on Friday when Mary Jo and Paul come in here and do Windows Weekly Live from 1 to 4 o'clock Friday afternoon. I think we have a full house already, but that's going to be a lot of fun. Windows Phone 8.1 was announced. It'll appear on Windows Phone handsets at the end of April, early May, and it will have a very Google Now-like Cortana. I think they might compare it more to Siri than Google Now. Google Now doesn't have a personification.
Right.
Cortana, though, does some interesting things.
Sounds like rich Corinthian leather.
Yes.
We were watching Joe Belfiore do the demonstration, and his sister called. And he says, oh, yeah, and Cortana is reminding me to ask about her dogs. And what they didn't show you is how does Cortana know about that?
That's creepy.
Now, Jeff, the creepy line. But you know, I pointed out at the time that while Apple, because of their conscious decision to respect users' privacy, cannot do a Google Now-style feature very well, Microsoft can. They've got Bing. They've got a search engine. They've got ways to gather those signals. They could conceivably do a Google Now-style.
They could, and I think the public is ultimately going to embrace that kind of thing because it's just so cool. People love Google Now. The problem with Google Now is they still are not really putting it in front of you. And when they do put it in front of you, they don't really give you enough stuff. I want a torrent of Google Now.
I want more. Yes.
I want more, and I want it
I keep on
in my
more.
Face the whole time. But
there's some flaws, and maybe they're still working on those. I keep getting told. I searched once a long time ago for a window a glass replacement company, and I still to this day my Google Now cards get it's only 8 minutes to Curtis Windows. I didn't want to go there in the first place. Yeah.
But enough already with the Windows.
Enough with the Windows. And there's nowhere I could turn that particular thing off.
I had a really interesting experience the other day where I got information about a flight in Google Glass, which went from the Google Now app in Google Glass. And it said, oh, flight so-and-so is on time and it's going to be leaving at this time. And I'm like, what flight? So I asked my wife about it and she said, oh, yeah, that's her brother was flying.
Right.
She had received email from her. So now they're not only looking at my Gmail, they're looking at... They know that my wife is my wife, and they're looking at her Gmail to tell me about...
Well, that's weird.
Yeah.
How do they know she's your wife?
Well, probably because I have her designated...
It didn't appear in your Gmail?
How do you know
no.
it's her brother,
I'm pretty
Mike.
Sure it didn't. But they, you know...
that's strange.
They tend to know that... I mean, I've also got her brother circled. I've got her... I have a lot of communication with her brother, so they also know that I have a relationship with the brother.
They might know it with you.
So it's kind of, I don't know, they're doing some voodoo there that's kind of interesting.
I think that's one place you do get a creepy line. I think that's where you do get the creepy line, when you can't figure out how they know.
Yeah. Yep.
That's really what freaks people out.
That's key, is they have to reveal that and give you control over it. Otherwise, you're creeped,
So there's another thing at the Build conference that we covered this morning that I thought it was kind of interesting, which is that a website popped up yesterday called windowsondevices.com, and I don't know if they've announced this yet at the Build conference by Microsoft, but this website called windowsondevices.com popped up, and then it went away. But before it went away, people went through it and found all kinds of stuff about talking teddy bears, robots, smart coffee mugs, the Internet of Things running Windows, and this is going to be powered by Intel's Galileo platform. So they're going to do something roughly equivalent to Android Wear, but less about wearables and more about the Internet of Things. And it seems to be aimed very squarely at makers and builders and educators and, you know, the sort of the hardware hacker market, which I think is great. And in fact, it has to be said, and it's probably more coincidence than anything else, that ever since Satya Nadella took over Microsoft, they seem to be a much better company. I don't know if you guys have perceived that, but they seem to be doing all kinds of stuff.
How can you make that much change that fast, right. Mike? I mean, this is the Queen Mary, and so a guy comes on with a new paddle.
Yep.
I think that's wishful thinking.
Well, could be. I mean, the thing is that Microsoft is the frustrating thing about Microsoft is they're always working on great stuff and they withhold it. One example is Microsoft Research, which just is one of the best research labs in the industry, and you never see this stuff.
True.
They withhold it somehow, either the internal politics of the company or something prevents them from executing on many fronts that they really could hit home runs and just for the last 10 years, just year after year, they just fail to execute on the stuff they have and have been working on. And so here, I don't know how much it takes to just turn things on, to let things go forward, to announce things that have been in the works for several years. I really don't know. One possibility is that Ballmer suddenly achieved enlightenment in his last year and got a bunch of things in motion that are now Satya Nadella gets to take credit for. But another one is that Satya Nadella is basically, you know, things like, you know, not squelching Android Nokia devices, things like, you know, the big having an announcement almost entirely about an iPad product. I mean, that was...
They didn't even mention Windows. Yeah.
I mean, barely. That was, you know, and is that, can Ballmer be given credit for that? No. I'm not so sure.
In fact, Ballmer was the one holding back. I think this is Satya Nadella's coming out, was Satya Nadella's coming out party. But it's a longstanding tradition in technology. Remember the book Fumbling the Future, how Xerox invented then ignored the first personal computer? Woz went to Hewlett-Packard and said, I've just invented the Apple One. Would you like to sell it? No.
They did that twice.
It's a long-standing tradition.
HP purchased Palm, which had the WebOS, which was a third alternative multi-touch user interface, a very innovative one.
Beautiful.
Different from the others that had this huge future on all devices, even into the desktop. Once again, they had the future of computing in their hands, and they're like, nah, we spent a lot for it. But you know what? We're just going to ignore it and then just sort of let it go away. Idiotic.
It happens a lot.
Unbelievable.
Anybody as old as us has covered it long enough. We've seen it happen time and time again. Chad, you'll see it too someday.
Maybe with YouTube.
When you grow up, you'll see it all happen.
Fumbling the future. We're going to take a break, come back, get our number, our tip, anything you'd like to submit, Mike, to our pool of stuff.
Sure.
In just a second, our show today brought to you by our friends at Personal Capital. I had Personal Capital's founder on Triangulation a couple of years ago, Bill Harris. He was a former CEO at Intuit and PayPal and learned a lot about how people use money, keep track of money. He wanted a solution for people to track their investments better. And he realized that before you can even talk about wealth creation or investing, you've got to understand where all your money is. And that's so hard. You've got bank accounts, charge cards, stocks, 401k. Do people still call them charge cards? I think I just dated myself. Charge cards, credit cards, 401ks. They're all on different websites with different usernames and passwords. You can't see it all. You want to see the landscape. So he created Personal Capital. You set it up, and within minutes, you're seeing live, real-time dashboard of your financial situation on your tablet, on your phone, and, of course, on your desktop. And then, of course, you get an investment checkup, see if you're paying too much. You're in fees and investment advice. They'll give you tailored investment advice so you can start building your retirement, building your future. And best of all, and this makes sense, it's free. It ought to be free. Why spend money on this when you should be putting that money in your savings, your investments? PersonalCapital.com/twig. I think he created a great adventure, a great idea. And if you're curious, the way they monetize it is just like Mint and other products. By giving you recommendations, by giving you personalized recommendations, and taking a commission if you decide to buy it. It's very unobtrusive. They do a very nice job. And they give you great advice. PersonalCapital.com/twig. Replicant in our chat room says, too bad Mike Elgin can't share his brick pizza oven on Twig.
I could bring it in, I think. I think it'll fit in the Prius.
Mike and I were talking yesterday about me. I want to build one now.
Yeah, it's so
what
great.
What a great idea.
Well, we when we moved to Petaluma, we looked at a lot of houses. And there are some my wife liked. And this one, when I saw that pizza oven, I'm like, this has to be the house. We're getting this house. I don't even care if the roof keeps rain out
it's
or whatever.
It's outdoors. You throw wood in it. It heats up. It's and then you huge, can just cook.
That's right. It's got a big steel door. When you open it, it's like... Yeah. And then you'd like shove pizza in there. It's like 700 degrees. It's fantastic.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
Really awesome.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, Jeff, I think you need to come back.
I'll make you pizza.
Pizza parties at Mike. Are you coming back? Look at that. It's his Google Plus page. What about the hat? Tell me about the hat. What is that? Is that a chef's hat?
That's a chef's hat.
You're wearing a chef's hat.
I want people to know who's in charge of this oven.
You actually own a chef's hat.
I own a chef's hat.
Now I have to have a chef's hat.
You're wearing
a chef hat parody.
It gives you authority.
Is he wearing glass in that picture?
Yeah, Google Glass.
Of course he is.
And yes. I posted a Google Glass video of the whole pizza process as well. So it's really,
I want to film.
Yeah, keep going down if you want to play. I don't know if you want to.
If you don't follow Mike on Google Plus, you're missing one of the best, most prolific posters on Google Plus. He really
keep going.
He really. Have you looked at your views? This is
333 million.
Jiminy crikey, yeah, Christmas!
A lot. It's a lot. Jeez. I was so astonished when I saw that. It's like, what the heck?
I can't. That's amazing. But you know, of course, the king of all this is Trey Ratcliffe. Let me see if I can go to Trey's.
Yeah,
page. Will we see it if I go to his page, or does only Tracy?
Yeah, you'll see it. No, you'll see it.
You'll see it, yeah.
Oh.
Well, they put followers back up. They took followers down for a while. Now it's back up.
Now they have both, I think. I think they switch it up. Sometimes they don't show any numbers.
Look at that. 333 million views.
I've got 43 million.
Wow. I'm some pathetic number I don't even want to mention.
Really puts things in perspective. Google Plus is, there have been also some recent reports about.
It ain't a ghost town. I take it back. Town. So Trey has 4.5 billion views.
Jesus.
7.3 million followers. He's probably the most followed. I don't know who is, but he's probably one of the most followed.
Did I tell you about my Morocco story and Trey Ratcliffe? When I went to Morocco about a year ago and just was, everywhere I looked, I thought, Trey Ratcliffe. Of all photographers that I know of, should come to Morocco. And I posted some stuff saying, you got to come to Morocco. He just went to Morocco.
Good.
And my God, the pictures he posted from Morocco were just stunning.
Right. Larry Page has more followers, 8.1 million, but he's only got a paltry 29 million views.
Well, he doesn't really get Google Plus like Trey and I do. I think he needs to work on it. He needs to spend more time just posting.
What was Trey, pardon me for asking this question, but how well known was Trey before Google Plus?
He was well known, but Google Plus really helped put him on the map, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I have a mere 16.9 million views. It's so pathetic. And I don't understand how you all get millions of followers. I have 500,000 followers on Google Plus. I've never been able to crack that. I don't know why that is.
I was on a recommended list for some time.
Yep. I'm still on it. It's
no, apparently I'm not on a list. I feel better about myself.
Gina was on it too.
I know. You all have millions of followers. It's not like I don't post. I post all the time.
But it doesn't matter because...
What?
The algorithm still decides what to show to whom. It's very much like Facebook. Yep.
You can still have a huge...
But it's not business-oriented. And you know what? And it works both ways. Of course, I only see what the algorithm chooses to show me. One feature... Hey, Google, if you're listening, one feature I would like to have is the ability to turn on all for the people I follow.
Yep.
Oh, because you can't, like Facebook, you don't see all of everybody's posts. Oh, that's not good. I thought that slider, but you can't.
You can do the slider, but it doesn't go to 100%. It goes to a lot, but not everything. I agree with that. The other thing is there's a 5,000 circle count limit. You can't circle more than 5,000 people, and that bugs me to no end. Every other day, I have to go in and uncircle a bunch of people so that I can circle the people that I want to circle. So if you're listening, whoever...
Circling.
Here's the real test. How many does Scoble have?
Followers or?
The interesting
thing. Oh, no. Scoble only has 91 million views. He's not even in the ballpark.
The interesting thing about Google Plus, though, is that there's no automatic traffic. Like, as Jeff was saying, and you really see it in the comments and the engagement. If you put a boring post up there, which I do all the time,
it's genuine.
You get hardly any traffic. If you put something that's really hot, it goes crazy, even if you don't have a bazillion followers. So he's got 5 million.
Scoble's got 5 million, 91 million views, which I think that's a low number of views for the number of followers he has, frankly. I mean, when Trey's got 7 million, he's got, what was it, 4 billion views? 4 billion!
I can give Scoble a hard time about that. I got 333 million views. So
you got a third of a billion, dude.
You really work it.
But that's what I was, that's how we got into this. One of the most prolific and best posters on Google Plus, and that shows you it really is it's the quality of your posts. You do good posts, you do consistent work, people will follow you on Google Plus. Mike, do you have a pick or a tip or something you'd like to share with us?
I do. Things a little bird told me, which is the new book by Biz Stone. This is it's not getting a lot of buzz, but I think it's really a great book. We recently saw the excellent book Hatching Twitter, which gave us the origin story of Twitter. This is about Biz Stone's. It's like a cross between a manifesto and an autobiography. But he talks about how he ended up as a billionaire almost by accident at multiple stages in his life. I wanted to point this out here, which is the dumbest thing I've ever seen in a book.
It says, if this book were limited to 140 pages, it'd be over. It would end here.
How many trees had to die for that page to
exist? And by the way, it continues on for another 100 pages.
That's right. Yeah. But it's an engaging book. It's pretty well written, and I'm really enjoying it. It's a nice
really. This is why people. This is, by the way, why nobody's talking about this book and why people don't hear about it. Their impression of Biz that maybe he's a little bit of an egotist.
Yeah.
The first chapter has his business card, Biz Stone, genius.
Well, he actually tells the story of why he had that business card, and he got it from where most good ideas come from, which is Roadrunner cartoons. Wile E. Coyote had a business card, I think, that said Wile E. Coyote, comma, genius. Something like that. So that's where it came from. And he talks about how he has it's a very personal book, actually. He says that there are two Biz Stones. There's the introspective, nerdy Biz Stone who just is kind of self-effacing and so on. And then there's the egomaniacal Biz Stone that he turns on when he needs to.
Right.
And he needed to when he was hungover and had a bunch of interviews at Google. And he was like, oh, yeah, and started telling him, you know, started interviewing him. But it's a really interesting book that talks about how one person made it from just an obscure blogger to becoming this gazillionaire.
So you recommend it?
I do recommend it. It's a very enjoyable book. Just came out Tuesday.
Well, you know what? We'll try to get him for triangulation.
I think that'd be a great
interview.
Stephen
Colbert says, in Things a Little Bird Told Me, Biz gives away all his secrets to success. I advised him against it. If you're not inspired and informed by this book, then you haven't read it. That's pretty good. Yeah. High praise from Colbert. Yeah. Things a Little Bird Told Me. All right. Good pick. Mr. Jeff Jarvis, your number of the week.
So Google has 49% of mobile advertising.
Wow.
According to eMarketer.
Now, who has the rest?
Says that, Facebook has 18%.
Oh, is that all? Really?
Wow. 3%. Now they say that the time spent, Google has 18% time spent, Facebook 17% time spent.
Oh, that's terrible.
Well, but I'm not so sure. I don't know what the methodology is behind that. Because it's the same problem with saying the time spent on Google.com. Google puts ads in lots of places.
Right. And so their numbers brought down by the fact that people see it in search results and then quickly.
Well, I don't know what the methodology is, but I would just wonder.
Yeah.
So Google brought in $14.5 billion in mobile ad revenue. Facebook generated under half of that, or $6.8 billion. But let's not forget, Facebook was zero with mobile not very long ago at all. And now its stock is going up because it's doing so well in mobile. So I think that's important.
Here is Wile E. Coyote's business card, just in case you're interested. Does say genius.
It certainly does.
Now, Biz didn't put that have brain will travel.
Yeah, that's
on
a good line, too.
It's going to be on my business card. Might have brain.
What was Zuck's CEO sucker? Or I'm a
CEO bitch.
Bitch, right.
I'm CEO, comma, bitch.
There's another guy who had a Google business card, and he was kind of an academic type. And he was told at Google that he could make up his own title. So he came up with the title Jolly Good Fellow, which I thought was a great title.
I think my title, Chief Twit, is pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Yes.
It's both aggrandizing and deprecating at the same time.
And it's
and true.
It's true.
Meaningful, yeah.
And it is who I am. The Twit, the Chief Twit, which carries no power. So I'm sorry Gina's not here, because remember last week we were talking about the new HTC One, the M8, I guess is what we'll call it. And she had her old one had broken, and she bought the Google Play Edition, but she hadn't checked out yet. Now, if you do get the Google Play Edition, it's still going to be a couple of weeks away. So this is actually not a Google Play Edition. This is the one and all its HTC Sense glory. This is the Verizon one. And I would tell Gina, I've told her this before. She still doesn't buy it. Don't be put off by the Sense skin, because actually it's pretty tolerable. It's much more googly than the original HTC one. Well, for instance, the original HTC one had those capacitive buttons at the bottom. They were non-standard. Now they've gone to the standard, you know, back.
And by the way, Leo, well, stay right there for a second. Yeah. As I remember.
I hated that.
You hated that. You're the one who wanted the physical button.
I did, and I was wrong.
Okay, all right, fine. Thank you.
I did. I was wrong. I didn't like the HTC One. I at least wanted, you know, I didn't want something completely non-standard either.
Yeah.
But I did like the fact that all my phones up to that point had a home physical home button that I knew where the home was. But no, I was wrong. What I guess my complaint was I don't want to waste screen space with a menu on the screen. These screens now are so damn big you can afford it. And the HTC menu bar at the bottom is actually smaller than the standard Google KitKat menu bar. So it doesn't take up much space. And I do agree with the thinking behind it, which is as you rotate the phone and so forth. Originally, I thought they would move the menus around. The menus stay where they are. And that was my big complaint, is you don't want menus moving.
Right.
Remember that? And they don't. They stay where you expect them to be. They're always here. So that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. The screen is gorgeous. It's 5 inches. That's what the Nexus 5 is. It's bigger than Gina's old HTC one. Still 1080p, 441 dots per inch. Really gorgeous. And I think the camera, and that's what we were talking about, is pretty remarkable in this. In fact, I wasn't crazy about the original HTC One camera. She liked it. It's 4 megapixels and the ultra pixel idea, better low light photography stuff. They've done things to tweak it to make it better. So I actually am pretty happy with this. Now, you asked the right question, though, Jeff. Do I give up the Moto X?
Right.
Which Mike and I both are Moto X fanatics.
Yep.
The Moto X camera is so bad. I think it comes down to how important is a camera to you.
Yep.
If a camera were not important to me, I wouldn't give up the Moto X because I really like the always listening. I like that it knows when you're driving, when you're in a meeting. It will read you it. I'm going to really miss this on the HTC One. When you're driving and a text comes in, it reads you the text. It says, do you want to respond? Yeah. And you respond. That is great stuff.
It's great. If somebody came out with a phone that was essentially the HTC One with the Moto X always listening stuff and that, plus the Lumia camera, the Lumia 1020 camera.
Then you've got something.
I would pay anything for that phone. I would,
that's $1,000.
I would pay $5,000 for that phone.
What?
Well,
let's be reasonable.
It's easy to say because they're not going to do it. So I can just say that. But I want, you know, it's
I
like,
agree.
Why do you have to pick between a good camera experience and, you know, voice command?
I do think there's hope for you because Lenovo has said, or somebody, I don't know, whoever owns Motorola now, has said that this summer there'll be a Moto X. And if I were Motorola, if I were Lenovo, that's exactly what I would do is I would say, okay, we got it down. The Moto X was great, but the screen wasn't great and the camera wasn't great. We want to make those better. If they make those better, I might go back to the Moto X this summer.
Definitely.
But for now, no, I've made the choice. I'm going to carry the HTC One. It's hard to give up that great camera, that great screen, which is, it's hard to give it up. So, all right, we found somebody with even more page views. I don't know how this is possible. Bert's found a guy named Romaine Guy? Who's that?
Romaine Guy.
Romaine Guy.
You guys don't follow Romaine Guy?
Who is he? He's got 15 billion page views.
He's a guy from Romaine.
He works at Google. He attended... Oh, he's French.
He has 86,000 followers.
Is that 15 billion? It is. He must be a very... Oh, I actually follow him. He's in my photographer group, so I guess he's a photographer. It's not surprising that the great photographers are the ones who get the most attention on Google+. It's such a photogenic site. Wow. Is he number one, Romaine Guy?
I don't know.
It's astonishing.
15 billion views.
He's following you, too.
That must make Trey feel terrible. He's following me?
Yeah. The arrow goes both directions, which means you're following him, he's following you.
Well, now I feel better. Even if I don't have a lot of followers or views, at least I have Romaine Guy.
I'm not following him, and he's not following me. This is outrageous.
Hey, it's so nice to have you, Mike Elgin. Mike is our news director here at Twitter. And can I say what a great job? And I know that people are going to say, that's self-serving. You hired him. You're knocking it out of the park. You're doing exactly what we brought you in to do.
He is doing a great job.
Which is to really raise the tenor of conversation here. If you don't yet watch the new TNT every Monday through Friday, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 2000 UTC, you're really missing what has become a deep news show with great guests, great insight, and it's exactly what I was hoping we would get from you. So,
well,
thank you.
I am loving it because I am such a fan of great journalism, and every day I get to haul these great journalists in, and we talk about the news, and we also talk about the journalism, and so it's really a joy, and I'm really enjoying it.
Good. And I know, again, this sounds self-serving, but I'm really very, very happy with what you've done. Mike also kind of runs the entire news operation. So Tech News Tonight, while Sarah Lane hosts it, is also a Mike Elgin joint. And all the breaking news stories and the live news stuff, and we're going to get better and better. In fact, we're going to build a little set for Mike in his office so he can feed us quick breaking news hits.
Keep me out of the general office area.
Well,
just keep me in there. So
if you'd wear shoes, I wouldn't feel so bad. But
not going to do it. It's not going to happen.
It's the pants. I wish.
Free country man.
He's got glass. He's got a chef's hat. Shoes, not so much.
You need pants.
Follow society's rules.
And, of course, it's always a real pleasure to have Jeff Jarvis on, another guy I really consider not only a great friend, but a brilliant and wonderful commentator on this world around us. Jeff's blog is buzzmachine.com. His book is Public Parts and Gutenberg the Geek. And anything else? He's a professor of journalism at CUNY. Anything else you want to talk about?
Well, yeah.
Not are you yet. Working? Are you scribble, together. Scribble, scribble? You're writing something?
I'm working on something for the school, but later.
And we do have to get together and talk about the basement.
In fact, I'm we're probably going to be back there on May 15th.
Oh, all right, deal. We are going to negotiate
before then, so we can.
I am desperate to do this. The more I think about it, the more I like it.
We're telling people, but we are absolutely desperate to do it.
Thank you, everybody, for watching.
Send you email.
Say again.
I will send you and Lisa email to schedule
email.
The call.
That's the problem. I never read email.
It'll end up in your promotions.
Lisa will read hers.
Updates.
If you had a priority inbox.
We do this show 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesdays on the Twit Network. Please watch live if you will. That is 2000 UTC. If you can't watch live, please do watch after the fact. On-demand audio and video available anytime. At twit.tv/twig or wherever finer netcasts are aggregated. I realize I told people the wrong time for TNT, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern time, 1700 UTC. So please tune in for that. Thanks to everybody in the chat room, everybody live in studio, and thanks to all of you watching at home. I'm Leo Laporte. We'll see you next time on Twig.